Today is Wednesday, July the 24th, 2024.
Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Microsoft CrowdStrike Windows Crisis. Windows PCs across the globe had been hit by a bug. What happened? A major internet outage disrupted flights, banks, media outlets, and companies across the world. In the United States, hundreds of flights were canceled last Friday morning, and some public transit systems reported impacts. CrowdStrike said it was gradually fixing an issue affecting access to Microsoft 365 apps and services. CrowdStrike is a firm that provides security software to businesses around the world. CrowdStrike is a U.S. firm that is being used by over half of Fortune 500 companies. CrowdStrike updates had a defect that impacted Microsoft Windows operating system, adding the incident was not a security incident or cyber attack. The issue has been identified, isolated, and a fix has been deployed, said a statement from CrowdStrike. The company CEO, George Kurtz, apologized for the disruptions. Microsoft, meanwhile, said the underlying cause has been fixed, but residual impacts will affect some of its Microsoft 365 apps and services. CrowdStrike issued a flawed update that effectively crippled millions of Windows PCs in the countries all over the globe. The affected systems were unable to restart properly and simply display an error screen known as the blue screen of death. The fault has been found and a fix has been issued, but early indications are it will require each affected PC to be fixed manually, which could be a very slow process, given that large businesses often have tens of thousands of computers in different locations and that many employees now work from home. The impact of this flaw has already been enormous. Airports have grounded flights. Hospitals and medical centers have suffered disruptions. Customers have been unable to access their bank accounts, among many other consequences. It's important to note that there isn't a problem with Windows itself, but rather with Windows computers running CrowdStrike software, which are largely confined to businesses. Macs, Linux PCs, and Chromebooks are also unaffected by this flaw. The advice is more nuanced for people who have a Windows PC supplied by their company. Here, it may be worth checking with your company's IT department before switching on a work-supplied PC to ensure there's no risk of it being affected. Even though a fix has been issued, it may take companies some time to validate the fix. Luckily, a fix is out there, but it seems a very manual process at the moment. However, businesses must test their updates thoroughly and have multiple fail-safes in place. However large the company is, but as it is often the case, it is simply impossible to simulate the size and magnitude of the issue in a safe environment without testing the actual network, especially when security risk is looming. The inconvenience caused by the loss of access to services for thousands of people serves as a reminder of our dependence on big tech in running our daily lives and businesses.
The advice may also be academic for many computers in work environments which are left running or in sleep mode overnight precisely so that they can benefit from the security updates that are meant to keep systems protected, but in this case have caused them to fail. CrowdStrike is a U.S. firm that advertises being used by over half of Fortune 500 companies, said one of its recent content updates had a defect that impacted Microsoft Windows operating system, adding that the incident was not a security incident or cyber attack. The issue has been identified, isolated, and a fix has been deployed, said a statement from CrowdStrike. Microsoft, meanwhile, said the underlying cause has been fixed, but residual impacts will affect some of its Microsoft 365 apps and services. In the United States, hundreds of flights were canceled last Friday morning. American Airlines, Delta Airlines, and United Airlines were among those who grounded flights less than an hour after Microsoft said it resolved a cloud services-related outage that impacted several low-cost carriers. Public transit systems in the United States reported impacts. The Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority in Washington, D.C., said its website and some of their internal systems are currently down, but that trains and buses were running as scheduled. In New York City, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority also said its buses and trains were unaffected, but some MTA customer information systems are temporarily offline due to a worldwide technical outage. Around the world, outages disrupted the London Stock Exchange, caused major train delays in the UK, sent British broadcaster Sky News off the air, forced medical facilities in Europe and the United States to cancel some services, and caused disruptions at airports in Europe, Singapore, Hong Kong, and India. Travel disruptions were over 500 U.S. flights were canceled as global IT outage prompts ground stops. What is the impact of Microsoft CrowdStrike disruption on personal computing? The recent global IT outage caused by a faulty update from CrowdSource has had a significant impact on businesses and public services around the world. However, the impact on personal devices like home computers or mobile phones are unlikely to have been affected by this outage. The issue primarily affected computers running Windows software with CrowdStrike security software, which are largely confined to businesses. Microsoft has estimated that approximately 8.5 million Windows devices were affected by CrowdStrike's related outage, which is less than 1% of all Windows machines worldwide. While the percentage was small, the broad economic and societal impacts reflect the use of CrowdStrike by enterprises that run many critical services. The impact of this war has been enormous, causing disruptions in airports, hospitals, and other critical services. It is important to note that CrowdStrike software works at the low-level operating system layer, and issues at this level makes the OS not bootable. However, home PCs running Windows are less likely to have been affected, as CrowdStrike is predominantly used by large organizations. The impact of the Microsoft CrowdStrike outage on personal computing is minimal, as the issue primarily affected businesses and public services, and personal devices like home computers and mobile phones are unlikely to have been affected. Google confirms Play Store app deletion starting August the 31st. Google to make Android ever more like iPhone. We have seen multiple iPhone-like feature announcements in recent months, and Android 15 promises the most complete set of privacy and security updates in a single release. One area where Android continues to trail iPhone by some considerable distance is app safety and security. Despite its efforts, Google can't seem to keep dangerous Play Store apps out of the headlines. And while its excellent Google Play Protect does a great job keeping many users safe, the threat is getting worse. By now, Google seems to be more serious about purging the problem once and for all. Android 15 will bring live threat detection to use on-device AI to analyze behavioral signals related to the use of sensitive permissions and interactions with other apps and services, and quickly flag abuses. But while that will cut the time between the app misbehaving and it being flagged and removed, that does not address the issue that it got into Play Store in the first place. From August the 31st on, the type of apps in Google's crosshairs will include those that are static, without app-specific functionalities. For example, text-only or PDF file apps, apps with very little content that do not provide an engaging user experience. For example, single wallpaper apps, and apps that are designed to do nothing or have no function. Google is being clever here, ramping up its quality threshold. We have seen multiple recent examples, but seemingly harmless apps getting onto Play Store and then either being used as a conduit to other malware-laced apps or more recently used as evil twin decoys for those alternatives. If one assumes that the most dangerous apps on Play Store serve little legitimate purpose, then this is an excellent approach to tightening the net. As such, while purging apps is not new for Google, this time it feels different. There is a building expectation that this will even hit some popular apps with millions of installs, and some legitimate apps which are low on the quality mark will also fail to make the cut. For developers, Google warns apps must provide a stable, responsive, and engaging user experience. Apps that crash do not have the basic degree of adequate utility as mobile apps, lack engaging content, or exhibit other behavior that is not consistent with a functional and engaging user experience are not allowed on Google Play. These are not the only changes coming into force on Play Store with enhanced security in mind. Google's July 17th policy changes include enhanced malware prevention, including a mandate that developers must remove third-party code from providers known to peddle malware, regardless of the code itself, as well as new rules on spyware prevention and tighter enforcement across the board. None of this should come as a surprise to developers, and they have 6 weeks now to assess whether or not they comply. The days of Google encouraging third-party stores and users to sideload apps, regardless of origin, are long gone. We are fast approaching Play becoming as near as similar to Apple's App Store as we could ever see. Meanwhile, if you can't get enough of those low-quality torches, horoscopes, PDF, and QR code readers, and quizzes, then now might be the time to stock up. Google isn't killing third-party cookies in Chrome after all. The advertising industry can heave a sigh of relief. Google won't kill third-party cookies in Chrome after all, the company said on Monday, and said it will introduce a new experience in the browser that will allow users to make informed choices about their web browsing preferences. Google announced in a blog post, "Killing cookies," Google said, "would adversely impact online publishers and advertisers." This announcement marks a significant shift from Google's previous plan to phase out third-party cookies by early 2025. The vice president of Google's Privacy Sandbox initiative wrote the following, "We are proposing an updated approach that elevates user choice. Instead of deprecating third-party cookies, we would introduce a new experience in Chrome that lets people make an informed choice that applies across their web browsing, and they'd be able to adjust that choice at any time. We're discussing this new path with regulators and will engage with the industry as we roll this out. Google will now focus on giving users more control over their browsing data. This includes additional privacy controls like IP protection in Chrome's incognito mode and ongoing improvements to Privacy Sandbox APIs. Google's decision provides a reprieve for advertisers and publishers who rely on cookies to target ads and measure performance. Over the past few years, the company's plan to eliminate third-party cookies have been riding on a roller coaster of delays and regulatory hurdles. Initially, Google aimed to phase out these cookies by the end of 2022, but the deadline was pushed to late 2024 and then to early 2025 due to various challenges and feedback from stakeholders, including advertisers, publishers, and regulatory bodies like the UK's Competition and Markets Authority. In January of this year, Google began rolling out a new feature called Tracking Protection, which restricts third-party cookies by default for 1% of Chrome users globally. This move was perceived as the first step towards killing cookies completely. However, concerns and criticism about the readiness and effectiveness of Google's Privacy Sandbox, a collection of APIs designed to replace third-party cookies, prompted further delays. The UK's Competition and Markets Authority and other regulatory bodies have expressed concerns about Google's Privacy Sandbox, fearing it might limit competition and give Google an unfair advantage in the digital advertising market. These concerns have led to extended review periods and additional scrutiny, complicating Google's timeline for phasing out third-party cookies. Shortly after Google's announcement, the UK's Competition and Markets Authority said that it was considering the impact of Google's change of direction. Windows 11 start forcing OneDrive backups without asking permission. Microsoft really wants you to back up files and folders to OneDrive. Microsoft has made a questionable change in Windows 11 that takes away your freedom of choice for OneDrive backups. Without prior notice or explanation, Microsoft now force activates the automatic folder backup with OneDrive feature when you set up a new computer, all without asking for your permission. First, when you set up a new Windows computer while connected to the internet and using a Microsoft account, you usually see OneDrive on your desktop. The app synchronizes data from folders such as images, documents, music, and videos, which can be useful in certain cases. In worst-case scenarios, however, you may set up Windows and immediately be confronted with a desktop that's cluttered with files and folders. This is likely to cause all kinds of frustration. Previously, you had to explicitly activate automatic folder backups, and Microsoft would ping you with recurring notifications to remind you of the feature if it wasn't enabled. Now, however, Microsoft seems to assume that everyone wants OneDrive backups activated by default, thus forcing it on without exception. You may not even realize until you set up a new computer and suddenly see all your old files again. If you don't want your Windows computer to back up everything on your desktop and in other folders to OneDrive, you can deactivate it. If you have an older version of OneDrive with a classic tab interface, go to the Backup tab and click Manage Backup and then Stop Backup. You will need to confirm the setting again. Alternatively, you can uninstall OneDrive altogether if you don't want to use automatic backups at all. This would, of course, be the simplest solution, but Microsoft might not like it at all. This is Microsoft being much more than just a big brother. 33,700,000 motherboards expected to ship in 2024, signaling the end of PC market's dry spell. The four big motherboard manufacturers are expected to ship more motherboards this year. Now, judging from some industry reports about motherboard shipments, it looks like the PC market could be back in business. DigiTimes reports that, according to industry sources, motherboard shipments are set to recover in the second half of 2024. This is based on previous shipping information and estimates for 2024. Tallying up the numbers relayed, it looks like the four major motherboard vendors, which consist of ASUS, Gigabyte, MSI, and ASRock, might reach a sizable 33,700,000 motherboards shipped by year's end. This coincides with other positive developments in the PC and component industry, such as PC sales steadily increasing and fourth quarter 2023 GPU sales seeing a 32% year-on-year increase.
Now we can add motherboards to the list of PC components seemingly back in healthy waters. To put these developments in context, just 2 years ago, in 2022, the big four motherboard manufacturers shipped 30% fewer motherboards than in 2021, demonstrating the protracted downswing influenced by pandemic-induced chip shortages and post-pandemic under-demand for tech. Yes, there was a boom during 2021, but the trough in 2022's PCs and component market dipped far below pre-pandemic levels. After a topsy-turvy few years, the projected motherboard shipment data shows an estimated return to the level of motherboard shipments we had back in 2019, before any of the past year's big market swings. Much of this, by the way, might be to do with the upcoming Intel Arrow Lake and AMD Zen 5 CPUs, the former of which are likely to hit the market later in the year, while the latter are practically on our doorsteps. These processors, perhaps crucially, as far as the market's concerned, will feature more powerful NPUs for AI workloads, which is all the rage right now. With a healthier PC market, basic economics tells us that more supply tends to equal lower prices, provided demand doesn't also skyrocket. Market improvements in one area, such as with motherboards, also tends to knock into other areas. For example, if more companies are buying motherboards, then more companies are probably buying all the other components to slot into these motherboards, which means more demand, more money for manufacturers, more production, and so on. Microsoft bans China-based employees from using Android devices for work. Mandates switch to iPhones. Microsoft has told all its employees in China that they will soon only be allowed to use iPhones for work purposes. The ban on Android devices is part of a security-related Microsoft initiative for providing a unified way of managing and verifying employee identities. The mandate, set to come into effect in September of this year, was announced in an internal memo seen by Bloomberg News. It will require Microsoft China-based workers to verify their identities while logging into work computers or phones. The change is part of Microsoft's Global Secure Future initiative that is intended, among other things, to ensure that all staff use the Microsoft Authenticator Password Manager and Identity Pass app. While Apple iOS Store is available in China, Google Play isn't. Local smartphone giants such as Huawei and Xiaomi operate their own platforms in the country, but Microsoft has chosen to block access from those companies' devices to its corporate resources because they lack Google's mobile services. Any staff in the country using Android handsets, including those from Huawei or Xiaomi, will be provided with an iPhone 15 as a one-time purchase. The Redmond giant is designating collection points across China where employees can pick up their iPhones. Microsoft is also introducing the iPhones-only rule in Hong Kong, despite the Google Play Store being available in the special administrative region of China. Microsoft has been beefing up its cybersecurity recently following several embarrassing breaches. The company detected a nation-state attack against its corporate email network last year, identifying the likely culprit as Russian group Midnight Blizzard. The hackers had access to Microsoft's corporate network for a month, breaching some of the company's source code repositories and unspecified internal systems. In April, a government review of the attack on Microsoft's Exchange Online hosted email service by China Link Group blasted the company for allowing a cascade of security failures that were preventable and should never have happened. The report described Microsoft's security culture as inadequate and requiring an overhaul. Apple and Microsoft have not commented on the report, but it's easy to imagine Apple's welcoming the news, especially as China started banning iPhones from certain government offices last year, and sales of the devices in the Asian nation have slumped recently. presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and you, and how they all fit together. And I just came across a brand new title, not title, phrase. And we've heard about all of this work from remote and return to office and stuff like that. And one of the phrases that I learned about is called hushed hybrid. All right, let's talk about hybrid. That's where you work a few days via remote and a few days in the office and go back and forth in between. And this hushed hybrid is exactly what it sounds like. It is a non-official, it's going kind of against that company policy of everybody returning to the office. It's where certain select individuals will get the privilege of splitting their time between working from home and actually going into the office, even though the companies may be requiring very specific levels of, okay, you can work from home one day a week, but instead you work from home 3 days a week or four or even all five. And this is something that, as much as I am a proponent of the idea of work from home, as much as I really suggest that everybody should be able to work from home if their company allows it, if their management allows it, the idea of doing something like this, of working in this hushed hybrid where, okay, we're going to let you work from home this week, but don't tell anybody, that starts to build a lot of mistrust within the within the management structure, but also in your peer structure, as people start to notice, hey, where's Benjamin today? Oh, he's working from home. He had something special to take care of with his family or whatever. But then everybody starts to notice Benjamin spends a lot of time at home. He spends a very large amount of time not coming into the office. Why do I not get that particular perk? And this is not really a good idea for anybody to be doing this. Look, I believe in openness. I believe in the idea of setting policies and the company following through on those policies. And they have to. Yes, there can be certain situations where, yes, management from up on top, the highest of the management structure says, yes, these employees can work from home. Those employees should return to the office. I believe that, yes, there should be, there could be a balance where, yes, some people get additional benefits. Some people are just too far from the office to really justify dragging them in, especially if a lot of the work they do can be done remote. A lot of their productivity still stays high. There's not a problem with that. Again, if management fully up on top goes through and sets the pace across the company. But when we start going down to the level of individual managers and staff bending those rules or breaking them, all of this can really lead to lower morale. Look, this is something that we're never going to solve. We're never going to fully resolve where everybody's going to go back into the office. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of numbers that are still showing that the whole idea of work from home is a very desirable perk. And people are going to jump ship if a company gets too heavy-handed with the whole idea of return to office. It's a byproduct of what happened with COVID. I mean, we can't deny that a lot of people are very capable of working from home, but you can't pick and choose. It's like picking and choosing who is going to go to lunch with a boss every week? Who's going to get this particular set of increased bonuses just because they're friends with a boss or things like that? There is a drive for flexibility. There's a distinct drive for people to look for, at least if they're returning to the office, going closer to home. To the extent of, look, one of the latest numbers says 77% of workers are considering the location. If they can get a job closer to home or even work from home, then they're taking it. 50% of workers are actually stating that they're going to look for a new job if they are required to commute to a city center office 5 days a week. These are hard and fast numbers. These are recent numbers. This says that the entire work from home situation is very desirable. It's a great perk, but you can't break the rules of the company. You got to do this with blessing from up on high. And this is really important. The policies should be distinctly public. They should be clear. They should be transparent, because that is what's going to help with the various employee metrics. We're talking about satisfaction and productivity, well-being, and these are important things for a company to recognize in the modern day and age, especially when you're trying to reduce turnover, when you're trying to reduce that star employee from walking out the door. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Early signs when a solid-state drive may be at the end of its life. The performance and durability of solid-state drives have improved over the years, but solid-state drives don't last forever. Some key warning signs that your solid-state drive is at the end of its life and what you can do about it, if you can do anything at all. Yes, it's possible to recover data from dead solid-state drives, but it's not always easy. It's never guaranteed. It will take a lot of time, and the cost can be very expensive. Don't risk losing your vital work files, photos, videos, and other critical files. Be sure to do regular backups. System freezes, crashes, random reboots, and blue screen errors. These can all be symptoms of all sorts of problems with your PC, which means they can also be signs that there's something wrong with your solid-state drive. If you don't find any problems with your CPU or RAM, and you've updated all your drivers and Windows updates, and if you can't pinpoint the issue elsewhere, then there's a chance these random crashes are caused by a solid-state drive that's going bad. Solid-state drives slow down as they fill up with data, but they also slow down over time due to memory cells wearing out. While modern solid-state drives use a technique called wear leveling to make sure the right erase cycles are spread across the solid-state cells as evenly as possible, some cells will inevitably wear out faster than others. As that happens, performance across the drive can diminish because the controller has to work harder and harder to manage the data, causing slowdowns when write erase commands are performed. New solid-state drives also come with additional over-provision space that can be used to maintain performance and capacity as cells wear out. However, as this over-provision space is used up and those cells in turn wear down, the overall drive's performance will again suffer. If your solid-state device performance hit is recent, try moving big files off to another drive and see if that helps. Maybe freeing up some space, especially if your solid-state drive is near capacity, is all you need to reclaim speed. But if your solid-state drive is far from full and performance is noticeably slower, there's a good chance it's dying. While death likely isn't imminent, it may not have that much life left. If an active memory cell degrades to the point of being completely inaccessible, It's possible for the files on the drive to become corrupted or entirely inaccessible. For example, when you try to access certain files on your solid-state drive, Windows may give you the message, "The file or directory is corrupted and unreadable" error. This error may be intermittent at first, but if it keeps happening, especially with the same files, you may have a dying solid-state drive on your hands. If you get a specific blue screen of death saying that the file system needs a repair, that's a sign that major data corruption has occurred with the Windows files themselves and they need fixing. Sometimes this data corruption can be caused by software, but if it happens multiple times and or the file damage is particularly bad, then it's likely to be caused by a failing solid-state drive. You might be able to fix this with Windows' own repair service, which will automatically start when Windows fails to boot properly after an error like this. But it's a clear sign that your drive could be in trouble, and at the very least, warrants further investigation. If you're worried that recent crashes, blue screens, or falling performance might be caused by a failing solid-state drive, you might be able to use the Windows Event Viewer to see what may be behind them. Check the Windows Event View to see if the reasons for recent failures have anything to do with your solid-state drive. You want to particularly look out for any hint of bad blocks, as that is a surefire sign that your solid-state drive is struggling and may need replacing soon. If these bad block references are occurring for your main boot drive or a drive that contains important data like work files, then get them off the drive ASAP before performing a drive health check. One of the clearest signs that your solid-state drive might be dying is that it gets a poor health score in drive health check apps like Crystal Disk Info. I use Crystal Disk Info to regularly check on my drive. Apps like this will assess your drive and give it a health rating. For more modern drives, you may even get a health percentage, which represents how much life that particular drive has remaining. What's an acceptable drive health percentage? Well, that's sort of up to you, but if the health check app says your drive is in good condition, then you should have nothing to worry about. If a drive goes read-only, it's on its way out. You might bump into this issue when trying to install a program or move files onto the solid-state drive. If it refuses to do it, and if you get some kind of error that stops you from writing data, or if you're told that the drive is in read-only mode, good chance the drive is about to die. Solid-state drives do this as a protective measure, affording you a little bit of extra time to get your data back up immediately. When this happens, you should remove the solid-state drive from your PC and put it in an enclosure of some kind, effectively making it an external solid-state drive so that it isn't being read from constantly by the system. If Windows won't boot from a solid-state drive, that drive may very well be about to die. It's possible that there's some kind of issue with Windows files or maybe a driver conflict, but if you suspect your solid-state drive may be to blame, it's time to back up whatever data you have and get it off. Follow the Windows Boot Problems Guide first. If that doesn't fix it, treat the solid-state drive as dying and act fast to make sure your data is backed up and safe before it's too late. If you can't see the drive in Windows or worse, the BIOS, then the drive may already be dead. If it's a brand new drive, it could be just that you need to initialize it or add a partition. But if it's an older drive that suddenly disappeared, it's not a good sign. You could try putting the solid-state drive in an enclosure and seeing if it'll show up when connected to another PC. If that works, you should back up whatever data you can. Even if the drive starts working again, there's a good chance this second win is just temporary. Be proactive to early warning signs that your solid-state drive is at the end of its life. Do regular backups of your work files, photos, videos, and other critical files.
Microsoft removes documentation for switching to a local account
in Windows 11. But most Microsoft account sign-in workarounds for Windows 11 continue to work. One of the Windows 11's more contentious changes is that, by default, both the Home and Pro editions of the operating system require users to sign in with a Microsoft account during setup. Signing with an account does get you some benefits, at least if you're a regular user of other Microsoft products like OneDrive, Game Pass, or Microsoft 365. But if you don't use those services, a lot of what a Microsoft account gets you in Windows 11 is repeated ads and reminders about signing up for those services. Using Windows with a traditional local account is still possible, but it does require a small amount of know-how beyond just clicking the right buttons. On the know-how front, Microsoft has taken one more minor but nevertheless irritating step away from allowing users to sign in with local accounts. This official Microsoft support page walks users with local accounts through the process of signing in to a Microsoft account. As recently as June the 12th, that page also included instructions for converting a Microsoft account into a local account. Those instructions disappeared on around June 17th and haven't been seen since. Despite the documentation change, most of the workarounds for creating a local account still work in both Windows 11 23H2, the publicly available version of Windows 11 for most PCs, and for 24H2, now available on Copilot Plus PCs, which will be available later this fall for everyone else. The easiest way to do it on a PC you just took out of the box is to press Shift plus the F10 function key during the setup process to bring up a command prompt window. Typing as one word, OOBE /BYPASSNRO. Rebooting and then clicking the I don't have internet button when asked to connect to a Wi-Fi network. Other workarounds include using the Rufus tool to create a USB installer that will automatically bypass the Microsoft account sign-in requirement, or for Windows 11 Pro users, indicating that you want to join the PC to a corporate domain and then not actually joining in to a domain, setting the PC up with a Microsoft account and then signing out afterwards is also still an option. There is one workaround that has allegedly stopped working. It used to be that trying to sign in with a non-existent email account could give you a local sign-in option. But as of earlier this month, according to Windows Central, it looks like the Windows 11 setup screen will just ask you to try another email address instead. To be fair to Microsoft, all the big tech companies want you to sign in with an account before you can use all the features of the software. But neither Apple nor Google go as far as to mandate account sign-in to access basic functionality. Macs, iPhones, and iPads will all let you complete the setup process without signing in, though you do have to know which buttons to click. Google will allow you to use Chromebooks in guest mode, and Android phones and tablets are still usable without signing in, though this does make it more difficult to find and install apps. Microsoft's pushiness remains unique. There's definitely a difference between a company that would really prefer that you sign in and one that forces you to. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, what do you have for us this week?
Well, if you're thinking about antimatter containment, your brainwaves are probably cooking on Star Trek, but I found a solution with anti-splatter containment for microwaves cooking up any variety of messy mischief.
Okay.
The brand is Tovolo, T-O-V-O-L-O. They sent me their three-piece set of collapsible microwave food covers.
Okay.
These things pop out like an old top hat, right? Cheese can bubble and bring cleanup trouble all around the insides of a microwave, but pop open one of these covers, place it over the plate or bowl, and success. No mess, no stress. I sound like one of those guys on cable. Soup
at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And the vents in the top of the cover release steam, so what you cook doesn't turn into ook.
Okay.
Ever try reheating an omelet, a pizza, or a quesadilla? Even when mm-hmm. they pop while cooking, you can focus on your cleaning on the cover and not on the insides of the oven around it.
Sure, yeah, okay.
So the Tovolo three-piece collapsible vented microwave food cover set, and I love it, is about $22 on Amazon.
Okay. Very, very attractive pricing there.
Now, one more piece of magic. And it's called SDI. SDI is a port you may not be using, and you're going to talk about church, and I know it.
Yes.
When you think about connecting video, what kind of connector comes to mind? VGA? No, you're not that old. DVI, DisplayPort, HDMI. Not many people outside the engineering side of television are aware of SDI, which is short for Serial Digital Interface. It has a good pedigree. The Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers first standardized it in 1989.
The SDI I didn't know it was around that long. Okay, go on.
Oh, yeah. The SDI connection you're most likely to encounter has a quick twist-on, twist-off BNC coaxial cable connector. We used to call them bayonets, right? And can handle runs up to about 1,000 feet using standard 75-ohm RG12 coax cable. You'll probably notice a bandwidth rating. For example, 3G SDI can handle 1080p at 60 frames per second, 6G at 120 frames, 12G for 2160 at 60, 24G for 2160 at 120, or 4K at 30.
Now for those listening, 2160 is a different it's the same thing as 4K.
Yeah, pretty much.
A different name. Yeah. Go on.
A 10-foot cable might be less than $40. A 50-foot cable, a little over $100. Yes, that's more than an HDMI cable. But HDMI runs from a single output port to a single input port. SDI devices that you could regard as endpoints often feature a loop output, meaning you can add a second device with a second cable. Think of all the times you've seen a room with a lot of displays all showing the same content for a room size audience, right? Church, right.
Now, I'm going to pause you right there because you mentioned 50 foot. And what a lot of people don't realize is 50 foot is the suggested maximum for HDMI. I know you can get 100 foot cables out there.
Watch them degrade, right?
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail you, but I wanted to dive in on that. So, yeah.
Now, if you're doing video, think of adding a monitor right at the camera. That's just a little loop, it's easy. If you're not using a loop output port, it's a good practice to connect a 75-ohm Terminator. They're cheap. I get those for about $1.50 each. So, okay, you're not a commercial or broadcast studio. None of your gear has SDI ports. But there's something you have, maybe a 4K projector that would, for any reason at all, be easier to wire with SDI.
I went
to a specialist, a company named Black Magic Design, and got into amazingly compact converters.
Yeah.
Each converter is roughly the size of a small package of paper clips and both 12G rated. Each has two SDI connectors at one end, one HDMI port, and a USB-C power connector at the other end. For one, the HDMI is the input, and there are two SDI outputs. It's about $125 at Amazon. For the other, there's an SDI input, an SDI loop connection, and an HDMI output. It's about $145 at Amazon. Most of you won't care, but one reason to consider SDI is that coax cables are inherently shielded, which isn't the case with HDMI. And there are applications where that can be a security issue.
Yes. I will tell you, actually, one of the things you did mention, I was going to bring up church for this, the church I go to, as a matter of fact, a couple of different churches I've worked with as well. That's the suggestion. We go with SDI because, again, we run into that 50-foot run. That's a tricky thing. When you start going to multiple screens, that's a tricky thing in HDMI. And it's far more of a bulletproof situation, solution when you go with this SDI. Now, how would that translate? Oh, most people, if you've got any kind of, I'll say even a medium-sized home, if you want to bring your video throughout the home. You want to watch the same television channel on multiple screens throughout the house.
Or security camera.
Or security cameras. Or, you know, there's a number of these different situations, and the SDI is just a much better solution.
And look, I'm just going to suggest, because we went through a lot of stuff really quickly here, check the wiki. Look up SDI. Find out what it's about. It's worth knowing.
Yeah, definitely. It's not talked about as much, but people really need to know about it. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that is Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the Chinese typewriter. Meeting time is Thursday, July the 25th. Meeting time start is 6:45 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting. For more information, the website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. The website is acgnj.org. The Tech Ed Connect has something new this coming August. They will have a hybrid meeting Tuesday, August the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And the hybrid meeting is, they have a venue for a general meeting in person. Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York. The zip code is 10583. And they will also have an online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The Kings Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, August the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.